The next morning, after I'd driven Lauren to the airstrip and watched him take off, I went looking for Ral Davidson. I found him in the bottom of a trench, measuring a slab of sandstone. He was covered by a skimpy pair of shorts and a mass of hair that almost completely obscured his features. But he was burnt a deep mahogany brown by the sun and was lean and fit. I'd become very fond of him. We sat on the edge of the trench, dangling our feet over the side, and I explained to him about the quarry. "Gee, Doc, why didn't we think of that before?" he enthused. That evening we drew up an elaborate search pattern, with a schedule to enlarge the area of search in expanding spirals each day. Ral's gang was temporarily withdrawn from the excavations within the temple and armed with machetes for the assault on the thick, spiny vegetation on top of the cliffs. The whole search was planned like a military operation. I'd been dying to find an opportunity to use the walkie-talkie radio sets with which Lauren had unbidden supplied us, and this was the opportunity. Ral and I checked the radios, shouting things like, "Over to you," and "Roger," and "Read you 5-5, at each other. Peter Wilcox muttered something about Boy Scouts, but I think he was a little jealous that he hadn't been invited to join in the search himself. Leslie and Sally, however, were infected by our enthusiasm, and they victualled the expedition with sufficient food and drink to keep an army bloated and drunk for a week. They turned out in a pink dawn, still in their pyjamas and dressing gowns, Leslie with her hair in curlers, to wave us off and wish us luck. At the head of my gang of stalwarts, laden with food and equipment, feeling a little like Scott or Bold Cortes, I led them towards the gap in the cliffs which had become our regular route to the top. And 10 hours later, sweaty, bedraggled, scratched by thorns, stung by hippo fly and other insects, broiled by the sun and in a filthy temper, I led them down again. We repeated this routine daily for the next 10 days, and on the 10th evening, when we paused halfway down the gap in the cliff to rest, Ral suddenly looked at the steep sides of the gap and said in a voice of wonder, "Gee, Doc, this is it." For 10 days, we had been using the steps cut by the ancients into their quarry. Thick growth had covered the neat terraces from which they'd sawn the red stone. We found some of the half-formed blocks of masonry still in situ, only a little undercut and almost unweathered in this protected gully. The marks of the saws were fresh upon them, as though the workmen had laid down their tools the day before, instead of 2,000 years ago. Then there were blocks cut in the rough and abandoned halfway through the process of dressing. Others were completed, ready for transporting, and yet others were in transit, discarded haphazard along the floor of the gully. We cleared the undergrowth from around them, and were then able to follow each fascinating step of the process of manufacture. The whole team came up to assist. They were jubilant with this new success, for we'd all been a little put down with the recent total lack of progress. We sketched and mapped, measured and photographed, argued and theorized, and there was an evident renaissance of enthusiasm in all of us. The feeling that we'd reached a dead end in the investigation was dispelled. I have a photograph taken by one of the Bantu foremen who thought us all mad. We were clowning it up, posing on one of the bigger blocks of masonry. Peter strikes a Napoleonic attitude, hand in the breast of his jacket. Ral's hairy visage is adorned with a ferocious squint, and he poises a pickaxe murderously above Peter's head. Leslie is coyly showing a little cheesecake, and that is almost as bad as Ral's squint, with whose legs she could kick elephants to death. I am sitting on Heather's lap, sucking my thumb. Sally has Peter's glasses on her nose and my hat pulled down over her ears, trying to look hideous but failing resoundingly. This photograph illustrates the mood of those days. After their assistant was no longer needed, the others went back to their separate tasks with renewed energy. Ral and I stayed on in the quarry. I brought up my theodolite, and we set about calculating its extent and the amount of masonry removed from it. It was impossible to measure accurately the irregular excavation, but we decided that approximately 1.5 million cubic yards of rock had been removed. Then, by a study of the method of quarrying and using the volume of abandoned blocks as a very rough guide, we guessed that the ratio of dressed, finished blocks to waste material would be about 40 to 60. And finally, we arrived at a figure of 600,000 cubic yards. Up to this point, we'd been working with fairly factual figures, but now we pushed off into an ocean of conjecture. "Well, at least it's not as bad as drawing a dinosaur from its footprints." Ral defended us as we used the map of the foundations of the temple together with our calculation of rock volumes to reconstruct a complete elevation of the vanished city of the moon. "Here, let me do that." Irritably, Sally took the paintbrush out of my hand on the first evening after she'd watched my efforts for 10 minutes. "I think the batter of the main walls is a little excessive," Peter murmured critically, watching her. "If you compare the walls of the elliptical building of Zimbabwe." "Yes, but take the temple of Taxien at Malta," Heather interceded, "or the main walls of Knossos." And before Ral and I could do a thing to prevent it, the project had become a group effort that replaced the nightly songfest in the common room. With everybody contributing from their own particular area of the dig and from their own specialized talents and interests, we built up a series of pictures of our city. Massive red walls, ornamented with the chevron patterns of the waves that made Phoenicia great. Red walls that caught the rays of the setting sun, the evening blessing of the great sun god Baal. The tall towers, symbols of fertility and prosperity, rising from the dark green foliage of the silent grove. Beyond it, the vertical gash in the cliffs that led through a secret passage into the mysterious cavern. Again, a symbol of the organs of reproduction. Surely this must have been sacred to Astarte, more commonly worshipped by the Carthaginians as Tanit, goddess of earth and moon. And so ranks of white-clad priests wound in procession through the grove, past the towers, and into the secret cavern. We knew that the Phoenicians made human sacrifice to their gods and goddesses. The Old Testament describes the infants delivered to the flaming belly of Baal, and we wondered what dreadful ritual our peaceful emerald pool had seen, depicting the victim dressed in gold and finery and poised on the edge of the pool with a high priest lifting the sacrificial knife. "If only it went so deep," Sally exclaimed. "Ben wanted to get divers to go down, but he says they couldn't work so deep." In the area between the inner and outer walls of the temple, where the layer of ash lay thick and where the majority of golden beads and richer ornaments had been discovered, we drew in the quarters of the priests and priestesses. This would be a maze of mud walls with thatched roofs. We reconstructed the streets and courts of the priests and nobles. "What about the king and his court?" Peter demanded. "Wouldn't they live within the main walls also?" So we divided the area between the quarters of the priests and the court of the kings, drawing on what little we knew of Knossos, Carthage, and Tyre and Sidon to give our paintings life. Ral had found the gate through the outer wall. It was the only opening, and it looked towards the west. From it, a road would have led directly down to the harbour. Sally drew it in. "Yes, but there would have been a market, a place of trade beside the harbour," Ral suggested, and pointed to the map. "This would be it, the area Peter has been puzzling over." Can you imagine the piles of ivory and copper and gold? And Leslie sighed. As and slaves standing on the blocks to be sold, Heather agreed. Look, hold it, hold it. This is supposed to be a scientific investigation. And I tried to restrain them. And the ships lying on the beach. Sally started to paint them in. Huge biremes with their prows shaped like ram's heads, covered with gilt and enamel. The walls and towers rose again. The lake refilled with bright waters. And the harbors and taverns were peopled with hosts dead for 2,000 years. Warriors strutted, and slaves whined. Noble ladies rode in their litters. Caravans poured in from the land to the east, laden with gold and treasure. And a white king strode out through the great stone gates, with a rosetted shield on his shoulder, and his armor a sparkle in the sun. The project was fun, and it served also to prod our imagination. By the time Sally had put the last touches to our painting, 4 weeks had passed, and as a direct result of it, Peter had discovered the shipyards suggested by Sally's biremes beached below the city. There was the keel of a ship laid on the slip, with the main frames in place. The unfinished vessel had been burnt, and its charred parts scattered. Only imagination and faith could recognize it as a ship. I knew my scientific opponents would challenge it, but carbon-14 on the charred wood gave us an approximate date of A.D. 300, the date which we had defined as that of the Great Fire. The project gave me an excuse to spend more of my time with Sally. I began taking my lunch and bathing costume up to the cavern. At first there was an awkwardness between us, but I worked hard at setting Sally at ease, and soon we were back in that friendly, bantering relationship that made us such a good working team. Only once I referred back to our more intimate association. "Have you still got the blues, Sal?" I asked. And she gave me a long, frank gaze before replying. "Please, please give me time, Ben. There's something I have to work out with myself." "Oh, okay." And I smiled as cheerfully as I could and resigned myself to a long, long wait. Sometimes the others joined our lunchtime sessions at the pool, for even when the heat was a hissing 115 degrees outside, it was cool in the cavern. We splashed and shouted, and the echoes boomed back at us. One of my indelible memories is that of Leslie, clad in a frilly little pink bikini, romping skittishly around the pool like a lady hippopotamus in the mating season, pursued by the indefatigable Ral. 5 weeks after my return, I went up to the cavern with good news. I just received a radio message from Larkin. "Lauren is arriving tomorrow." I was disappointed in her negative reaction because I was sure she'd overcome her initial dislike of Lauren for my sake and that she'd begun to like him. I went to meet Lauren at the airstrip, and I was shocked. He had lost 20 pounds in weight, and his skin, which usually glowed with golden health, was now a chalky grey. Beneath his eyes were smears of dark plum that looked like bruises. "Ben." He put an affectionate arm around my shoulder and squeezed. "It's good to see you, you old bastard." But his voice was weary, and I noticed the threads of silver at his temples, which were newly acquired. "My God, Lo, you look terrible." "Thanks." He grinned wryly and slung his bags into the back of the Land Rover. "No, seriously, Lo, are you sick or something?" I was distressed to see him looking so ill and haggard. "I've been on a rough one, Ben," he confided as he climbed into the Land Rover beside me. 4 weeks at the bargaining table, had to do it all myself. Couldn't trust anyone else to handle it. The other side sent in teams, changing them when they were worn out." "You're going to kill yourself," I scolded him, sounding a little like a nagging wife. And he leaned across, punched my arm lightly and laughed. Ah, you're a shot in the arm, partner. Was it worth it? And what was it about? It's big, Ben. Bloody enormous. Copper and iron. Southwest Africa, near the Kunene River. Massive ore bodies lying in association. Low-grade copper and high-grade iron. Together, they're a treasure chest. The weary tone was gone from his voice. I put those little Jap bastards over the table and I roasted their asses. They will put in the finance for a deep water harbour and a railway line to get the stuff out. That'll cost them 150 million. He was exultant, the colour coming back into the pale cheeks. One of my companies will do the construction work, of course. He touched a finger to his lips in a conspiratory gesture, and I giggled delightedly. I enjoyed him in this mood. I'll put up for the pelletization plant. And so he went on to outline the scheme, laughing and punching my arm when he recounted each bargaining point which he had scored. What will it make for you? I asked at last. And he looked at me, slightly put down. You mean in terms of money? He asked. Well, surely, yes. What else? Hell, Ben, I've explained it before. That's not the important thing. It's not money, it's exports and employment and opening up new resources and building for the future, realizing the potential of our country and getting one hell of a kick out of it, I suggested. He laughed again. You're too shrewd, Ben. I suppose that's a lot of it. The game, not the score. Have you seen last week's Time magazine? I asked. I knew that would needle him. Ah, oh, for God's sake, Ben, he protested. Your name's on the list of the world's 30 richest men. Those bastards, he muttered darkly. Now everybody doubles their prices. Why don't they mind their own business and let me get on with mine? And in the process, you are killing yourself. You're right, Ben. I do feel a little spent. So I'm taking a week. A whole week's holiday. Huh, big deal, I sneered. A holiday with your bright young men arriving every half hour for conferences and the rest of the time with you hanging over the radio set? Forget it, he smiled. I'm getting away, and you're coming with me. What do you mean, Lo? I asked. Oh, tell you later. He avoided the question, for we were approaching the branch in the dirt track, and I automatically slowed to turn down to the huts. Straight on, Ben, Lauren instructed. I want to go up to the cavern. Been thinking of that place for weeks. His voice went soft and reflective. When things got really tough there at the table, I'd think about the peace and tranquility of that place. It seemed to... He stopped and coughed with embarrassment. Lauren doesn't often talk that way. Sally was working at the rear wall of the cavern. She wore a green silk blouse and tailored khaki slacks, with her hair loose and shiny. As she looked up to greet Lauren, I saw with mild surprise that she wore lipstick for the first time in weeks. She noticed his haggard features immediately, and I saw the concern in her eyes, although she said nothing about it. Her greeting was subdued, almost offhand, and she turned back to her easel. Lauren went immediately to the portrait of the White King. I drifted across to join him, and we sat in a friendly, relaxed silence, examining the strange figure. Lauren spoke first. Do you get the feeling he's trying to tell you something, Ben? It was a fanciful question for Lauren, but I treated it with respect, for he was clearly in deadly earnest. No, Lo, I can't say that I do. There is something here, Ben, he said with certainty. Something we have overlooked. The key to this place, the whole secret of it, is in this cavern. Well, though, we could... I began to speak, but he wasn't listening. Sally left her easel and came to join us. She sat beside Lorin and watched his face with complete attention. This feeling has never let me down, Ben. Do you remember the Desolation Valley mine? My geologists gave it a thumbs down, but I had this feeling. Do you remember? I nodded. Desolation Valley was now yielding 20,000 carats of gem diamonds a month. There is something here. I'm sure of it. But where? He turned to stare at me, as though I'd hidden whatever he was searching for. Where is it, Ben? The floor. The walls. The roof. And the pool, I said. All right. Let's start with the pool, he agreed. It's too deep. No diver, Lowood. What do you know about diving? He demanded. Well, I've dived a couple of times. Oh, for God's sake, Ben, he interrupted brusquely. When I need a heart operation, I go to Chris Barnard, not the local vet. Who is the best diver in the world? Jacques Cousteau, I suppose. Fine. I'll get my people onto him. Well, that takes care of the pool. Now the floor. Dealing with Lorin is rather like being caught in a hurricane. At the end of an hour, he had outlined a scheme for a thorough investigation of the cavern. And at last he suggested casually, "Okay, Ben, well, why don't you go on back to camp? I'd like an hour or so alone here." I was reluctant to miss a minute of his company, but I stood up immediately. "Are you coming, Sal?" I asked. Lorin wanted to be alone. "Oh, Ben, I'm in the middle of..." "Oh, that's okay, Ben," Lorin told me. "She won't disturb me." And I left them in the cavern.